time.
We have a lot to cover. We will be in here every Wednesday night of this quarter. And this is what we did last year in getting prepared for LTC, where we encourage parents and grandparents to study the book that our children are going to be reading in preparation for the Bible Bowl, which is going to be the book of 1 Samuel. And so we would like for you to be aware of the book. It's plus, if you're not involved in LTC at all, it's going to be a good study for all of us. And so we'll be in here every Wednesday night of this quarter. Bill Wagner will be teaching next week. You haven't got one yet. I need two or three helpers to pass out material, if y'all don't mind. Thank you. What's going around right now is the outline of 1 Samuel. Actually, it's not so much an outline as it is what sections of the book of 1 Samuel we'll be covering each week. And tonight, we're going to attempt to go through the first two chapters. And next week, Bill will be taking you from chapter 3 through chapter 6. That'll be the longest section for the quarter. And we have some shorter ones so that we can catch up if we're behind and there's some things that we want to talk about. I want you to be free with asking your questions. And if there's anything that you have a question about, you want to talk about, or want us to go over, then absolutely make sure that you let me know, and we'll be happy to do that. I'm going to wait till all those are passed out, then we will get started, word of prayer, and get started. If you happen to see Scott Pruitt, be gentle with him. And also be big brotherly, motherly, fatherly to him. He had a precancer removed on his chest or stomach area on the side today. And he has strict doctor's orders not to lift more than 5 pounds for the next 2 weeks. So if you see him doing something like that, jump all over him. Scott Pruitt. You probably won't see him tonight till he comes in. He's shopping with the teens tonight. I'll bring these in every week. And if you don't have one, I'll make mention of them and you can get them. I'm kidding about this, but I'm going to say it anyway. You have one tonight. If what I want to say is you're allowed four. And so if you leave yours at home on a continuing basis and keep wanting one, we'll be making mental counts. But we have a copier, and we can make as many copies as we need, huh? Do what? Have a what? Mental, so we're okay. Well, it's communication is a two-way street. It's got to be delivered and it's got to be received. And I think the receiving part was what was messed up there. Okay. Let's begin with a prayer. If you would bow with me. Our Father in heaven, we are so grateful you wrote your word for us. And there's so much of it. It covers so many different things. But when we see the depth of what you're after and what you're giving to us, it is an overwhelming book, every aspect of it. We ask you to be with us as we begin this study of 1 Samuel and help us to grow in our understanding of it. Be with us tonight. Help us to be attentive to your word. Help us to be devoted to the things you teach and to the way you would have us to live. In the name of Christ we pray. Amen. I'm going to show you three maps, first of all, to start with. And we'll be putting maps up on a regular basis because they're going to be helpful to us to see and to understand. You probably can't read a thing on that map. And I'll just point out, you can recognize the Dead Sea and the Sea of Galilee. And this area here is Ephraim, and then this area is Judea. And I'm about to take the next map, and it's going to zoom in. The length of territory that's described, especially for David, as we get toward the end of the book of 1 Samuel, is going to be from Dan to Beersheba. And Beersheba's not even on the map. It's down pretty low. This is the Negev all down here, which is the southern part. But that's the entire territory, and also including areas over here that belong to David and also expanded by Solomon. But that's another book. This is a blow-up of that area of Ephraim. You can still see Ephraim up here, which is the tribal land. And the cities that are going to be important are Shiloh. Shiloh is the place where the ark is. That's where it went when they took the land of Canaan. That's where it will stay until you get to next week and Bill tells you that it's moved. And it will move next week and come back to a different place. If you come from Shiloh, you come all the way down, you'll see Jerusalem. And down here is Bethlehem. But if you go up, here is the city of Ramah. And that is where they think the location is. And that's where Samuel is born. And that's where his parents live. And they live in the city, this city of Ramah. And they travel on an annual basis to the city of Shiloh in order to worship God. And in these first two chapters, those are going to be the two primary cities. That's a long way. Well, it's really not all that far, but you can look at how mountainous it is, and you can see how difficult of a journey it would be. And I know it's hard to read when I've got the topography up and you're looking at all the mountains. And so this becomes a little easier map to read and to see. And again, there's Ramah, and up here Shiloh. And that's where they are. Aphek, you'll talk about next week. That's where the Philistines are camped out when the Israelites come over to do battle with them. And that's at the city of Aphek. And not to get ahead, but we're going to run into the Philistines. We're going to do that next week. And they're going to be a very predominant part through the life of David and through the nation of Israel for a while. They were not part of the land of Canaan. They were not the Canaanites. When the Israel came in order to take over, the Philistines were not a part of the nations that were there. They are referred to in history as the sea people who came. And one of the reasons that allowed that to happen was the destruction that the children of, or that God did to the nation of Egypt. And now there was no controlling empire. And his land was just to all these different tribes that were there that were not organized. And here comes the nation of Israel into it, and they're in the process of taking the land. And probably before they arrive, maybe sometime, I'm not sure of the dates exactly, but here come the sea people. And the sea people come and they set up city states. And they are going to be the Philistines or the Philistines. And Bill may have more to say about that next week. But that's a map. Any question on the map before we get started? Okay, here we go. Who wrote 1 Samuel? Smart group. Who wrote 1 Samuel? Samuel the first? Who wrote 1 Samuel? What's the problem with saying Samuel wrote it? Huh? Well, he could write about his birth after he's born. He dies in the book. And he is dead before the book is finished. So you know for certain he didn't write 2 Samuel. And here we are in 1 Samuel. And the question is, who wrote it? Guess what? We're told. In the book of 1 Chronicles, chapter 29, verses 29 through 30. As for the events of King David's reign, from beginning to end, they are written in the records of Samuel the seer. The word seer, you know another word that you could put in place of it? Prophet. They were written in the records of Samuel the seer or the prophet. The records of Nathan the prophet. Now, who was Nathan with? David. That's the man that came to David and accused him of the sin with Bathsheba. The records of Nathan the prophet and the records of Gad the seer. With all of his reign, his power, and the circumstances which came on him, on Israel, and on all the kingdoms of the lands. And another individual that's not named there because he wasn't alive probably at the time. These are the early ones who recorded it. But individuals who may have copied later and wrote and helped to write other books would have been a man by the name of Ezra. And probably some others that are not named for us. But this tells us who wrote the history of David from beginning to end. And really, that's what 1 Samuel is. It's the beginning, and we'll get to that in just a second. There's another passage, and that's in the book of 1 Samuel, chapter 10, verse 25, where it says, Samuel explained to the people the rights and the duties of kingship. Where did he get that? The law of Moses. Because before they ever had a king, God knew they were going to have one. And he gave instructions for the king when he was giving the law to Moses. And also because God was talking to Samuel. So he had two sources. Samuel explained to the people the rights and the duties of kingship. He wrote them down on a scroll and deposited it or placed it before the Lord. That may mean in somewhere in connection with the tabernacle. Then Samuel dismissed the people to go to their homes. This is when Saul was anointed as king. And here we have the record of Samuel writing history, writing about the events that are taking place and words that are spoken. And so he's a writer. He's a scribe, and we have record of him doing that. And so it just emphasizes again what's said in 1 Chronicles chapter 29 when it says all the events in connection with the life of David were written by Samuel, Nathan, and Gad. And that's what's told us as we come near the end of David's life. What's the purpose of this book? Why is it written? Why did God put it in here? Interesting. to highlight two major events. The establishment of the monarchy in Israel and the preparation of David to sit on the throne. Now you have to think about that a little bit and see the significance of it and the importance of it. So 1 Samuel tells us how the monarchy came about, how a king came about in the land of Israel. Because who was supposed to be the king? God was. But God knew from the beginning it would not be that way. And he made preparation for there to be a king. Well, this is the establishment of the monarchy in Israel in preparation for it. So who was the first king? Okay, are we awake yet? Or Saul. Okay. Saul was the first king. When Saul died, what would you expect? His son to be the next king. That's the way it's done in a monarchy. And so there has to be an explanation. Why do we have a kingship? Why do we have a monarchy? And why does this man, David, who has no relation to Saul, become the next king? And so we have the preparation for David to sit on the throne, the reason why Saul is removed, and the reason why none of his descendants are accepted, and the reason why this shepherd boy becomes king. And tying all of that with this, Samuel is the man chosen. The way this book starts, when it regards Samuel, in talking about his dad, there was a man. And it does that in a very key way in several places in the Bible. In connection with the birth of Moses, there was a man. There was a family. There was an highlighter. Emphasis is given to the coming of this person. Samuel is the man chosen to bring about both of these events. He's the one who starts the monarchy, anoints Saul. He's the one who announces to Saul the kingship has been taken from you, because God is going to have somebody else, a person after his own heart. And then he's the one who goes and anoints David as the next king. And so he's the one that's over all of that. Now, I may be completely off base on this, but when I put this slide up, put this slide together, and I look at it, what other figure in future events in the Bible does Samuel seem to be foreshadowing? Huh? John the Baptizer. John the Baptizer, God said, is going to come and usher in, get things ready for the coming of the king. And that's what Samuel is doing. He's ushering in and getting things ready for the coming of the kingdom, and then the coming of the king, who's going to be the forerunner of the true king, of Jesus himself. And there's a lot of things like that all through this book. And so that's the purpose of the book. What's the purpose? It's to see how these two events came about, which are both very important for the nation of Israel, but also very important for God's redeeming of us and his bringing to us a king who will be our ruler and be our leader. And in the book of 1 Samuel, Samuel is the man chosen by God to bring both of these events to pass. Now, we're going to get into literature. It's not English, it's Hebrew. But we're going to do it in English. And I want you to open your Bibles. I want you to go to 1 Samuel. And I'm going to give you two choices. Those two choices are going to be Samuel, Eli. And Samuel would be anybody associated with him that's important for him coming into place. And the other one is going to be Eli and those associated with him. And I want you to look at a contrast between the rise of Samuel and the decline of the priesthood in Shiloh. As a matter of fact, the priesthood in Shiloh is about to come to an end because the ark's no longer going to be in Shiloh. Never will go back there. And the priesthood of Eli, who and he and his sons are in Shiloh, that's about to go as well. Not the priesthood of Aaron. Not the priesthood of God. But Eli and his family's part in it is about to go. So we have a contrast. And the reason I want to show you this is because in studying the Bible, this is something that you need to look for. And looking for things like this will help you to find how the content of the Bible fits together. And it will help you figure out what's going on here and what's happening. And normally, just by reading it, we don't see it. But when we stop and we think about what we've read and what we're reading, and if we especially start making an outline where we look at key points and key words, then things like this will jump out at you. And it won't do it just in this first section, these first three chapters, but it will do it all through the Bible. It will do it in every book of the Bible. Sometimes it'll do it in a verse, but sometimes it'll do it in series or sections of chapters, and sometimes it'll do it throughout the whole book. And you have no idea what I'm talking about. So here we go. I want you to just kind of skim right quick. And I want you to look from chapter 1 through chapter 2, verse 11. What's all that about? Two choices, Samuel or Eli. Samuel, this is about his birth. And this is about the song that his mother sings when he's born. So we're going to call this A, the birth of Samuel with Hannah's song. And A, what we're going to do, the contrast is going to be A, B. And I'm going to tell you how it's going to go. It's going to go A, B, A, B, B, A. And that's exactly the way these first three chapters are written. It's a literary style that was used by the writers of the Bible, both in the Old Testament and New Testament. But it's not always A, B, A, B, B, A. It swaps up. And sometimes, I've mentioned before in sermons, it can start with a pinnacle and come down on two sides. Where the bottom two tiers are parallel statements, the next two are parallel statements, and the top one is the main one that was in mind. And so it's a literary style, and you get to notice it when you notice repetition. And the repetition keeps coming up, but you don't get it if you just read through the book. You get it when you stop and you think about key phrases, key ideas, put them together, and see the repetition of them. So, B, chapter 2, verses 12 through 17, I'm going to help you with this one. What's that talking about? Eli and his sons. And his sons were bad people. And we'll get into that a little more in detail. So you have a contrast. You have a contrast between Samuel's parents. What's different about his parents? Every year they do what? Exactly what God tells them to do. They go to exactly the place God tells them to go. And every year they do exactly what God has instructed to do. What are Eli's sons doing? Huh? Ignoring what God says to do. They don't pay any attention to what God says to do, and they get mad at you if you try to insist they do what God says to do. And so you have this contrast. Then we come back to chapter 2, verse 18 through 21. Samuel and his family with Samuel's growth. Now I want you to look with me at verse 21. Because it talks about, this is in chapter 2 now. And I want you to read with it verse 21. Meanwhile, the boy Samuel grew up in the presence of the Lord. So this talks about Samuel and his family. And what Samuel is doing after he has brought. I'll tell you what, let me interrupt. I've got so much in my mind I want to cover, and we're going to run out of time, but let me mention this one while we're in this particular section. Look at verse 18. Samuel was ministering before the Lord, a boy wearing a linen ephod. Now, you're going to read commentaries, and I've read some getting ready, that will say he was wearing a linen ephod. He was wearing the dress of the priest. Therefore, Samuel is a priest. No, he's not. He's a prophet from the tribe of Ephraim. But he's not a priest. So why is he wearing a linen ephod? Well, he's working for the priest, and he's working in the area of the tabernacle. There is a linen ephod that the priests are to wear, but it's very decorative. And there are specific decorations that it's to have. But the priest is not the only one to wear an ephod and it be linen. But they had a specific decoration for the linen ephod that belonged to the priest. Now, how do I know that? Let your memory go back, and you'll recall it as soon as we talk about it. When we get to the book of 2 Samuel, David is going to be moving the ark. And he's moving it the second time. And the whole time it's moving, what is he doing? He's dancing. He's rejoicing and dancing and worshiping before God. His wife notices what? Huh? He's acting like a fool because when he jumps up into the air, the linen ephod that he has on evidently blows up slightly or whatever with the wind or with the jump. And so it may be she was seeing his knees. It may be, I don't know how long it was or exactly the length of the dress, but she chastised him for lewdness and exposing himself. Because he was dancing and worshiping God as the ark was being moved. And what he was wearing was a linen ephod. Wasn't a priest. He wasn't dressed like a priest. He wasn't trying to be a priest. And this boy, Samuel, is working with the priest. And he's working in the presence of God. And he's wearing a linen ephod. And it may have been a special dress on special occasions for people who are specifically involved, but no necessary indication that he was a priest. But he was a prophet, and that's the way he's designated. It's the way he's designated all through it. Okay, so we got A, B, A, and we come to the next B. The sins of Eli's son with Samuel's growth. You notice the parallel. This was Samuel and his family and a reference made to how much Samuel is growing. And now we have the sins of Eli's son with a reference being made in verse 26 as to how much Samuel is growing. These verses are the verses where Eli chastises his sons. In verse 26, the boy Samuel continued to grow in stature and in favor with the Lord and with the people. Same thing said about Jesus. Same thing being said here about Samuel. And we have another B. There's a message that is given to Eli in chapter 2, 27 through 36, which takes us to the end of chapter 2. And the message of the man of God to Eli is, how dare you let your sons do what they are doing? There will be nobody from your house who will ever be priest again. It will be over for them, and they will come to the point where they realize that none of them are living to an old age. They will die when they are young, and the ones that are alive will go to the priest and beg for a role to play with the priesthood so that they can have food to eat. And they will be rejected because God has rejected them from being king. And the last section, which is A, is all of chapter 3, where God calls Samuel. Samuel, Samuel. And Eli finally tells him, say, speak, Lord, your servant listens. And this is the prophetic call of Samuel, which takes up all of chapter 3, and then we really change gears in chapter 4. In chapter 4, we go in a different direction. But these first three chapters have this setup, this literary setup of ABA, BBA. And if you take a look at that Psalms, you take a look at Proverbs. Well, Proverbs is a little harder, but some of them are that way. But you take a look at a lot of the books that are written, and if you start looking for similarities, and they may be separated, then they begin to give you a context of what's going on. What's going on here? Why this literary style? What is the writer trying to emphasize? Why does he write it this way? And really consider the writer to be the Holy Spirit. Why does the Holy Spirit put it like this? And why does he insert these things like this? Why? What's his point? What's his purpose? What is it? Huh? Contrast. Contrast between what? Righteousness and unrighteousness. Those that are listening to God and those that don't. Those that are honoring what God says and those that are not. Those who pay attention to what God says and those who do not. And that's what he's doing. And he's showing this contrast. And it's going to be a contrast that's going to stay with us all through the book of 1 Samuel. Three themes of 1 Samuel, and they all come from Hannah's song. So we're going to look at Hannah's song. You're wondering, when are we ever going to get to chapter 1 and chapter 2 and look at them? I'm wondering the same thing. Themes of Samuel from Hannah's song. I want you to notice the way these break down. Let me do this rather quickly, and we'll talk about it for a moment, then we'll go back and we'll look at the stories of chapter 1. These are themes from Hannah's song. You could call it Hannah's prayer, but it's really more like a song than it is a prayer. And if you've read Hannah's song, can you think of another song that's very close to it? Mary's song. Mary's song is very close to it. And so here we are, all these similarities with the coming of the kingdom, with the coming of this kingdom, and the coming of the Lord's kingdom. All these similarities. All right, here are the themes. In chapter 2, verses 1 through 3, and in chapter 2, verses 6 through 7, Hannah emphasizes the sovereignty of God. He rules everything. He's in control of everything. He's the one that makes everything happen. The sovereignty of God is over everything. You're not going to get away with doing what you want to do, because God rules and He will rule. And that's basically, can you just hear her talking to her, what do you call it, her sister, well, the other wife? How do you designate that? Is it a sister-in-law? It's her rival, yeah. But anyway, you can just see her in her mind writing this. With her in mind, whether or not she ever said anything to her or not. But God's sovereignty. The second one is the reversal of human fortunes. And that's in chapter 2, verses 4 through 5. The one that was full now has nothing to eat. The one that was starving is now full. The one who had the children now has nothing. The one who had no children now has seven. A complete reversal of human fortunes. What brought it about? The sovereignty of God and faithfulness to Him. And that brings about the reversal of human fortunes. The third one is kind of unique and strange for it to be here in chapter 2. And it's kingship. It's in chapter 2 and verse 10. As she closes out this song, that she will say, where am I? Those who oppose the Lord will be broken. The Most High will thunder from heaven. The Lord will judge the ends of the earth. He will give strength to His king and exalt the horn of His anointed. Horn means strength. She starts off the song with the word horn. And she says, my horn has been exalted. That means my strength has been exalted because of God and because of what God has done. And so here you have the three themes that run throughout the book of 1 Samuel. The sovereignty of God. Who's really the ruler? Saul or God? God. Who's the one making things happen to put Saul in the place he is? Himself or God? God. Who's the ruler, David or God? God. Who's the one putting things in place for David to become what he became? God. The reversal of human fortunes. Look at the change. What was Saul before he became king? A man of great humility, a man who was little in his own eyes. And then what happens when he forgets about God and thinks about himself and look at all that I have done? Then what's the reverse? He becomes a man so proud that no longer is he grateful for the kingdom. He now thinks it belongs to him. He now thinks it's nobody else is right to have it. Look at David, the reversal of fortunes. Shepherd boy. The youngest of his brothers. Made fun of by his brothers. Not a warrior. But he leads the army. And he kills Goliath. And he becomes the great king, David. Because he's a man after God's own heart. And God takes him and reverses his fortunes. Reverses his entire life. How many of us can tell that story? That being what God would have us to be has brought us to places we've never dreamed. Never dreamed we would go. And done things we've never dreamed. And here it is, the kingship. This book of 1 Samuel introduces us to the kingship. and being a foreshadowing of the King who is coming. Okay, go back to chapter 1. Let's take a look. We'll do this real quick and take a look at the stories that are familiar to all of us. We'll have to do it quick. There was a certain man. There we go. Somebody's coming and he's going to be important. And he was from Ramah, or Ramathaim of Zuphath, a Zuphite. Talking about probably the immediate family that he comes from. He's in the hill country of Ephraim. And this man had two wives. One was called Hannah. It's possible to translate it, the first was called Hannah. And the other, Peninnah. Why does he have two wives? It's a possibility in the Old Testament. It may be that one of the reasons God allowed polygamy and them to have two wives is that God himself would have two wives. When the monarchy started, God had one wife. It was Judah or Israel, either way. But then after Solomon, the kingdom divided. And you had the northern tribe of Israel and the southern tribe of Judah. And God had two wives. And they were sisters. One named Israel and one named Judah. And as the Bible unfolds, he will divorce Israel. And he will separate for a period from Judah. And it's fascinating to read the prophets and God's putting himself into this picture of marriage and describing his relationship to Israel and to Judah. So why does he have two wives? Notice who's first, Hannah. And what is it Hannah does not have? Children. How important are children to a marriage? How important are children to a marriage of an Israelite man in connection with the land that belongs to his family? And it may be that he went for the second wife because the first wife could not have children. And so he marries Peninnah, and she has children. She has sons, and she has daughters. Every year, year after year, they don't do this occasionally. They don't do this just whenever the notion strikes. They don't do this just whenever their team is not playing in the Super Bowl or the national championship. They do this every year. That's a little facetious, isn't it? Sorry. But they do this every year, and they go up to Shiloh, and there they offer the sacrifices. And that's where Eli and his two sons, Hophni and Phinehas, are the kings. Whenever they went, he would give to Peninnah and all of her sons and all of her daughters a portion of meat whenever they would go up to the sacrifices. And he would give Hannah a double portion because he loved her. And what would Peninnah do? Pick at her unmercifully because she can have no children. And she's constantly reminded of that and constantly put down by that. I wish we could learn this. I wish I could learn this. When Peninnah does this to her, is she saying more about herself or more about Hannah? She's saying more about herself. why are you being so mean? She's telling you about herself. Why do you hate me so much? She's telling you about herself. Why do you do this? Why do you despise me? She's telling you about herself. There's another story in Genesis. It's very close to this one in there. She has the children, but what does she not have? The love. Because he loves her. He loves Hannah more than he loves her. And he has a greater love for her. And you don't think Banana knows that? You don't think that infuriates her? You don't think that makes her so angry? And here we have another situation. She's angry, but who is she really angry at? Her husband. But does she take it out on him? No, because she wants something from him. She wants his love. So what does she do? She directs the anger at somebody else. And that happens so often. That happens so many different times. Her husband, when he sees how much she's upset, isn't it interesting? There's never any account of him talking to the other wife. Because what good would that do? She's just going to do it behind his back. Maybe he has talked to her. Maybe he has chastised. Maybe he has rebuked her severely, but hadn't stopped. And as long as it's getting to Hannah, it will not stop. As long as I can dig at her and I can see I'm hurting her, it won't stop. And so she puts up with this. And then I love this expression her husband says to her in verse 8, why are you weeping? Why don't you eat? Why are you so downhearted? Isn't my love for you more important to you than 10 children? And her answer is, no. Because all she can see is what she doesn't have. And it makes her where she cannot appreciate what she does have. And it doesn't matter how great what she has is. All she can focus on is what she doesn't have. Now, isn't that the same problem that Jacob had with his wives? Exactly the same problem that Jacob had with his. So they go up to the temple on this occasion, or to the tabernacle, and they offer the sacrifices. And you know the story of Hannah praying. But she's praying to herself. And her mouth is moving, but there are no words coming out. And there's Eli leaning on his chair up against the gate or the door. And he sees this woman running around with her mouth moving up and down and no words coming out. When are you going to stop drinking? Oh, no, my Lord. I am talking to God out of a heavy heart. I am not one of the wicked women. I have had no drink of wine or beer. But I speak to God out of a heavy heart. And isn't it interesting what he does? May the Lord grant you your request. It's not, well, tell me about it. Or tell me so I can fix it. You've come to the right person. You've come to God. And may God grant you your request. And she says back to him, just don't consider me as one of the evil women. And immediately her face is lifted up. And immediately she eats. She goes home. And her husband have a boy. She made a promise to God in that prayer. If you give me a son, I will give him back to you. And he will work for you and stay with you for the rest of his life. And that was her intent. And that's what she asked for. That's what she got. A boy does not go to the next feast. He may not go the next two. There's a three-year-old oxen that goes for the sacrifice, and it may have been the one she intended to offer from the first year. She doesn't go until he's weaned. And it may take 3 years before she stops feeding him. And he is weaned, and she has him those 3 years. Can you imagine this? How do you do this if you're Hannah? You're going to raise a boy who's going to belong to God and be separated from you and from the rest of the family. And he's going to belong to God, and he's going to work for God, and he's going to delight in it, and God's going to bless him. How do you do that? There's a lot to be said for intent. There's a lot to be said about what we start with from the very beginning. How do you think she talked to that baby when it was in her womb? What songs do you think she sang? What did she read to him? What did she say to him as she held him and as she rocked him and she fed him? For all those 3 years that she had him, if it was 3 years, and I'm just guessing on that. But for all that time that she had him until he was weaned, what was she doing? What was she saying? What was she talking about? Was she describing what he was going to be, what he was going to do, and how proud she was going to be of him? What would have been the reaction if every time she talked to him about it, she was bawling her eyes out and she just hated it that he was going away and she just regretted it so much and she just didn't want it to happen, but she'd made a promise and she had to do it? What's that boy going to grow up like? He's going to grow up hating God that took him away from his mother. But when she does this and talking about the great God that gave me you, and you're going to get to work for him all of your life. And she talks about it from the standpoint of a blessing. And how joyous it is. And she's so proud of him. It becomes Samuel. Boy, that's a tremendous thing to think about. And a tremendous thing to remember. Do you know what happens? It'll occur later on. I'll give you a heads up that we'll come back. You know what happens in a few years? What happens when the ark is taken from Shiloh? What happens to the priesthood? What happens to Samuel? Where is he living when David comes along? Ramah. What happened to Samuel? He went back home. What happened to the boy she gave to God? God gives him right back. And he becomes this great prophet of God. And so she sings this song, God's great power. Sings this great song of how God turns fortunes around when we put our trust in him and when we rely on him. God is bringing the king. And the king has come. And we get to live with the king forever and ever. So we start this book of 1 Samuel. And you have 2 minutes. But we'll stop there. Yes. I have no idea. I think what happened on this particular occasion, that the ridicule from Peninnah was extremely bitter and severe. And it just happened while they were there. And she was overwhelmed by it and just left, went out of the house and was praying to God. And Eli just happened to be there to see her. And because as you'll see toward the end of chapter 3, when she brings Samuel and turns him over to Eli, she has to introduce herself and remind him that I'm the woman that you saw praying. And this is what I prayed for. So they weren't close friends. And she had to reintroduce herself to him. Okay. You all are dismissed. Thank y'all.